From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Now, we dig into the meaning of a catchphrase that's become a staple in schoolyards and comedy routines. That's racist. Now, in the past, it was a loaded challenge. It meant something to accuse someone of racism, but no more. NPR's Neda Ulaby reports on the transformation of an accusation.
That's racist. It's practically a running bit on TV. Sometimes it doesn't even refer to race, like in the show Parks and Rec, in a scene about folding laundry.
Okay, so you always separate your lights from your darks.
That's racist.
Or in the sitcom Community.
You're saying I could be a lawyer.
I'm saying you're a football player. It's in your blood.
That's racist.
Your soul.
That's racist.
Your eyes.
That's gay.
That's homophobic. Okay.
That's black.
That's racist.
To an episode of Glee, when two kids are asked if they're dating.
Because we're both Asian, that's racist.
Totally racist.
Even Doctor Who.
Cacti. That's racist.
Kids are saying it too. Like the girls who made a YouTube video of themselves going through a Taco Bell drive-thru.
What's border sauce?
Taco Bell.
So racist.
And 14-year-old Gus Rachel says he says it too.
I mean, I admit to doing it sometimes, yes.
Rachel's and his friends in Lexington, Virginia started saying that's racist about 3 years ago. And they do it why?
I think I or other people just sort of do it as a way of mocking people who are overly sensitive about race issues.
Like the white kid who thought it was racist to say someone's black. Or another story, the kid who asked if a schoolmate was Chinese. Another kid yelled, that's racist.
They think that the term that's racist might just refer to things that are racial.
That's schoolteacher Suzanne Vostina. She teaches English at a public grade school in the Bronx. Her students are mostly black and Dominican, with a few Albanians and Vietnamese mixed in. She says they all say that's racist constantly.
One of our hall aides, she's heard kids say it when she's asked them for their hallway pass, or when she tells a student go back to class and the students will say that's racist.
Now, there could be racism in that scenario, but these kids also say it when they're all assigned homework. It's not just young kids either. Regina Bradley teaches college classes in African American literature. Her students say it too.
They were simply using it to lump discussions of race and race discourse all together. Because they were just saying because we brought up issues of race, that was considered to be racist.
Bradley thinks these kids are doing a couple of things. First, they're establishing themselves as not racist by calling other people out. Second, they're avoiding difficult discussions about race, still, of course, a sensitive topic. And she agrees with Suzanne Vostina, who thinks her grade school kids mimic shows like South Park and 30 Rock.
Tracy Morgan is always saying, that's racist to everything.
Usually to his white female boss.
You are unbelievable.
I'm unbelievable. What about your racist mess? Thinking a grown man is illiterate. That's the subtle racism of lowered expectations. Bing Crosby said that.
No, Bill Cosby said that.
That's racist.
One of 30 Rock's writers is comedian Hannibal Buress. He'll say that's racist, for example, in a bar.
Say a bartender is taking too long. This bartender is racist. Or is the bartender racist, but also just a bad bartender.
That's racist works in comedy, Buress says, because it pushes buttons. Scholar Regina Bradley says it also works because racism's often expressed differently than from a generation or two ago.
If it was the 1950s or when my grandparents were coming up in Jim Crow and somebody says that's racist, they're like, okay, well, duh.
The segregated neighborhoods and swimming pools of Bradley's grandparents have yielded to more subtle forms of discrimination. That's reflected in how that's racist is being used to shut down conversations or as a joke. And not just in schoolyards or sitcoms. Glenn Beck used it as a cheap shot when he called the president racist a few years ago.
This guy is, I believe, a racist.
Beck eventually apologized. Trivializing that's racist shows how much cultural confusion exists about race and racism right now, says Regina Bradley.
I think you can acknowledge the problem and also sweep it under the rug at the same time.
That's racist started as a virtual retort on internet discussion boards. It was a little video clip from a cult TV show, an African-American kid with the words, that's racist, underneath. People started dropping it into online arguments to quench or to inflame them. Musicians Himanshu Suri and Victor Vasquez loved the meme, so much they named their band Das Racist.
That was like an inside joke that was floating around.
It's a cool way to kind of undermine the seriousness and like inherent like sadness of talking about race. That's amazing. That's
racist. That's offensive. The band's smart, prickly sensibility has impressed critics and fans. But the name Das Racist has not worked out that well. Vasquez says some promoters won't put it on posters, and it's cost them a few gigs.
He says maybe they didn't really think through the implications of "that's racist," and they underestimated the power those words still have. Neto Ulibi, NPR News.
And that's the kicky music that means it's time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See, and I'm back in my seat.
Yay.
After a week away, and I'm here around the table with the Pop Culture Happy Hour staff. You know, I've promoted you.
Paid staff.
While you were gone, I felt that crew sounded a little swingers. I was not doing it on purpose, but I felt it sounded a little swingers. So I've upgraded you to staff. Glenn Weldon, tell me what you do for NPR.
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website, and I'm very pleased that we have solved our Holmes list problem.
Hi-yo!
Save that up for a week. One week.
Well, that's another day in paradise. Yeah. You know. Trey Graham, tell me what you do for NPR.
I am the movies editor at NPR.org, and I occasionally restore my sanity by participating in this podcast.
Very good. Stephen Thompson, what do you do for NPR?
I am an editor and writer with NPR Music, and I occasionally lose my sanity doing this podcast.
Well,
I did last week when I had to host in your absence.
As the staff discussed, last week during my absence, I was at the Silver Docks Documentary Festival in Silver Spring, Maryland. Very, very good find. Probably the top documentary festival in the U.S. Lots of very impressive movies. I saw 22 features.
That's a lot.
Good Lord.
That is crazy.
22, twisted monster.
22 features and 21 shorts, which ranged from 8 or 9 minutes at the short end to one of them was actually 40 minutes.
You know, I understand going to the movies to see a twisted fantasy about the way life is on this planet, but there's not enough life for that many documentaries. I'm sorry.
No, they were great.
They actually ran out of people.
Right? No, they were great.
21.
They were great. And some of them will be rolling out into either theaters near you or onto HBO or PBS, so on to TVs near you, or eventually to Netflix, where your cool friends will say, you got to see this. And what I'm really hoping is that at least one thing that I saw will be nominated for an Oscar, and I'll be like, oh yeah, I saw that back in the,
back in the day.
I saw that back in June.
Yeah, I saw that back in June.
And with any luck, listeners...
That was at the festival that I attended.
And with any luck, listeners, you will be able to say the same thing, or at least say that you read about it on the pop culture blog here at NPR, which is called...
Which is called Monkey See.
Yeah, I don't read that.
And I know you don't. And I'll give you a couple ones to watch out for. There's one called Buck, which is rolling into theaters right now, which is about the real life horse whisperer. Please don't panic. It's not like that. It's actually funny and fun. I mean, it is moving also, but it's
horses. There's whispering.
There's horses. There's whispering. There's music. It's pastoral, but it's a lot of fun. I would also suggest that you look out for two that are likely to be relatively accessible to you. One of which is called The Interrupters, which is by Steve James, who did Hoop Dreams. And that's about some people who work in a youth violence interruption program in Chicago. And also Project NIM, which is by the guy who did Man on Wire. And that one is about a very, I don't think it's a spoiler to say, a very ill-conceived experiment that was done in the early 1970s to find out whether essentially, and I'm oversimplifying, but essentially if you take a baby chimp and you raise it like a baby, will it basically become a human? And
will it not attack you and eat your face, is what you're
saying. And I don't want to spoil the outcome, but
the director's name is Faceless McGee.
this is the kind of project that if you're going to start with a baby chimp, you should know what you're going to do when it turns into a big chimp, because it's not going to want to wear pants anymore. I'm actually
the same way.
Yeah. So keep your eye out for those. And I will be writing about a bunch more of it on the blog. But I did have a lovely week. And as I was telling people all week, when you have a press pass, they let you go in the priority line. And so I kind of flitted from documentary. And you can go to whatever you want. And you don't have to buy tickets. And so you kind of flit from show to show to show. And so it's kind of like if they let you go to Disneyland. And you could be at the front of the line all the time. Except instead of rides, it's movies about children in war-torn countries.
The human condition.
Exactly. Yeah. Instead of the teacups, it's the human condition. So that's what I was doing.
That's going to be the name of my band, I think. The Teacups of the Human Condition.
Perfect. That's perfect. And awesome. You can also make that documentary.
Yes.
I would see that. So while I was gone, one of the things that I did write about for the blog, other than documentaries, was Cars 2.
Wait, Cars 2 wasn't a... documentary?
Wasn't it Silver Docks?
I thought it was opening at Silver Docks. I thought that was the whole point.
No, Cars 2 came out this weekend, and some of us presumably have seen it. I have seen it. Who else has seen it?
What?
No.
I've seen it. You guys didn't see it?
No, sorry.
Oh, good grief. Stephen Thompson, tell me about your Tell me about your relationship with Cars 2. Presumably you took your children.
Right. I took my children. You were actually present at the time because we went on your press passes.
That is true. I was. We all went together.
You witnessed my seeing of this movie. And I thought that you hit this on the head in your blog post when you said that the Pixar movies in general are about more than what they're about. WALL-E is a look at loneliness, and The Incredibles is an Ayn Rand tract, and A Bug's Life is about the way that the machinery of capitalism is oiled by the blood of the workers.
Sure.
And, you know, each movie is about sort of more than what it says it's about. You know, Toy Story 3 is about childhood and on. And that Cars 2 is about cars.
It's true.
That's a good line. It's a really good line. I'm not sure I buy it, because I'm sure that in the story meetings for both Cars and Cars 2, they didn't say this is a movie about cars. What they probably said, at least in the case of Cars 1, was this is about taking it easy, learning about that certain things in life are more important than trophies, and it's about the journey, not the finish line, and that kind of thing.
Right.
Is less like that. Cars is probably my least favorite of the Pixar movies. This movie in particular, and I don't think this is a bad movie.
Mm-hmm. Me neither.
And I had a lot of fun. My kids really liked it, but this movie is about beyond merely cars, is valuing the importance of being yourself and staying true to your friends. And that is also true of every other animated movie that has ever been made.
I think
makes this less of a successful, standout, Pixar-ish movie, which brings us to the question of, is Pixar held to a standard that is unlike the standard that the other major animation studios are
absolutely
currently being held
to? Absolutely they are.
And they did that by making a bunch of movies that are better than this one.
Yes.
Absolutely. It has these underlying messages, as all kids' movies do, about, you know, take care of your friends. And it's not just about cars in the sense that there's nothing else going on. Like, sure. I understand that. They do talk to each other and have personal relationships and so forth because it's,
given.
Because it's,
well, and do
because
I,
it's cars.
Do but. I understand correctly, they exist entirely in a world without humans? Like,
yeah,
the cars are the
whole,
population of this,
there's
this
a whole,
universe, right?
There's a whole rabbit hole that you can go down here because it's true. Okay.
It has been pointed out that one of the great logical flaws of this universe is that in a universe without humans, there is no compelling reason for cars, for instance, to have seats.
Right, exactly. Right. Or to be sized for humans or any other thing.
Who made them?
And it's not, well, even if we don't go down that whole intelligent design.
Where are the children? Where are the baby cars?
Right, but even if we don't go down that road, which let's not. one of the things that's charming and fun about Cars 2 is that there are people in the real actual world who are represented by cars in cars. Mm-hmm. Like the royal family of England is cars. Mm-hmm. It's made up of cars.
There is a car queen.
There's a car queen and a car Prince William, and there's a whole car. And it's cute. And in the best thing in the movie, and maybe I shouldn't give it away, but I'm going to anyway, the Pope car drives in a Popemobile. So there's a little Pope inside a Popemobile.
This is classic alternate universe. I mean, I don't see why you're having any problem.
I was not going to bring
this
up.
I wasn't sitting there like, this is so fake.
No, I'm not the person who, was it Bobcat Goldthwait who used to do the bit about going to see E.T. and the guy, when E.T. flew across the moon, the guy next to him was like, oh, right. And he said he just like kicked the guy like, I hate you, you ruin everything. But I'm not trying to be that person. I wasn't going to bring this up. Trey brought the whole thing about the car.
Yep.
One of the weird things about it is that it does exist in this completely other world, but obviously so does, you know, Bug's Life, and so do most of these other movies. It's not that it's not about anything at all. Anything invented for kids always has some little message in it. And it has that, and it's nice. It's fine. But it's not the kind of movie that makes me think, as I did when I saw Up, for example, that there are elements of it that where the storytelling is as sophisticated as anything that you see in movies aimed at adults.
Well, what do you think of the point that several blog commenters made, which is that this is probably even geared to even younger kids, because they did something very smart in creating these characters. These characters are the merchandise of this film.
Toy Story also falls into that category.
Yeah, but kids might want to play with a, I'm going to call it an action figure, not a doll, of Buzz
touching a nerve there.
But a lot of kids want to play with cars.
Absolutely.
A lot of kids
absolutely.
Want to play
and I said in the blog post, I think the drawbacks to this movie are largely ones that are going to bug me more than they would have bugged, for example, Steven's kids. I think they're more the things that adults really value in these movies and have really come to love about these movies that is a little bit lacking in this one. I think kids will like it fine. And I tried to say that in the blog post, and maybe it didn't come across enough, but I think kids are going to like it fine. It's a perfectly fine Pixar movie for kids, and I think they're going to like it and enjoy it and buy lots of stuff and demand that lots of stuff be bought for them. And I think they'll own it on DVD and watch it again, and that's all cool.
Mm-hmm. And I think the other way of saying what you were just getting at is that parents have gotten used to the idea that they don't have to worry too much about whether they're going to have a good time when they drag the kids out to see a Pixar movie. They know that it's going to work on two levels.
I mean, this is not a bad Pixar movie, but there was a certain amount of, when I was a kid, I was obsessed with cars. Mm-hmm. I had and still have a pretty impressive collection of Hot Wheels cars.
Which say, impressive.
You have the racetrack?
Let's put an asterisk after that word impressive. Uh-huh.
Okay, by impressive, I do not mean cool. Uh-huh. Okay. But when I was
notable.
In fourth grade and my best friend moved away, we celebrated our last day before she moved by reenacting the miniseries Roots using my Hot Wheels car.
Sure.
This is the Leslie Uggams car, you know.
It's
true. I mean, that's it's true. And so, I mean, what I'm saying is, I feel like I should have loved this movie more than this and its predecessor more than I did as somebody who has somewhat of a nostalgic fixation with cars.
Can we talk about the corporate reputation of Pixar? I mean, historically, Pixar gets a pass from the mainstream media if there's ever any kind of profile of an organization and they do something about the corporate culture of Pixar. These profiles are just a tongue bath. I mean, it's just this slavish emotion.
Well, I mean, Pixar is like Apple.
Well, right, and that's
that,
the same
that
kind of
way.
Thing. And whenever I read a profile of an organization like that, and it's just fawning over, you know, the design of the office and everything, I was like, well, is foosball really that exciting? Why why do I keep reading these same profile pieces? It is like Apple, and there's a reason for that. Yeah. I mean, there's some of Apple's DNA, because after all, John Lasseter...
The two are not unconnected.
Right, John Lasseter left Disney to join George Lucas's FX house, and then was bought by Steve Jobs, and then it's been through several different hands. But I mean, I understand that Disney is the great evil and DreamWorks is too slick, but there's just something about this that doesn't go away. And part of it is because they produce really good films, but there's something else going on.
One thing I would say in defense of the Pixar movies compared to, say, the DreamWorks movies, and as you know, there are DreamWorks movies that I think are really, really outstanding.
Really?
there's one about this panda.
Okay.
But, you know, one thing that Pixar, I think, does really, really well compared to recent vintage Disney animated films is that Pixar, I think, is very, very careful about keeping these movies utterly timeless. Mm-hmm. That is one thing that I will say that Pixar clearly has taken great pains to do, and that their movies have sort of a longer shelf life, and that you build up that reputation by putting out things that age really well. I mean, go back and watch Aladdin from 1992, and that movie could only have come out in 1992. It's full of, you know, like Arsenio Hall woof woof jokes. Now, part of that is Robin Williams' fault, and that's a whole separate podcast. but I mean, you know, the you know, really big shoe. You know, there's not that stuff in Pixar movies, and that's one reason. But, you know, one thing that it shares with Apple is clearly it's got a really terrific PR department.
Mm-hmm. Is it possible that simple chronology has something to do with this? If I'm not getting it wrong, it was only really Disney and maybe Warner Brothers for a long, long time, right? And then Warner Brothers kind of got out of the animation business mostly, and Disney kind of got bad for a while, and then Pixar came along and completely revived the animated film.
Well, the animated film itself, I mean, The Little Mermaid was kind of the
Beauty
resuscitation.
And the Beast, that's
well,
true.
The Little Mermaid was first. Little Mermaid and then Beauty and the Beast. Yeah. And you kind of had this, and then The Lion King. You had this massive, like all of a sudden animated movies were $300 million.
That's true. Right.
So Pixar, of course, also changed the landscape because they brought in the 3D animation that they use now. Which
right, a whole different, a whole new way for films to look.
Right, which at one point seemed like it was going to completely extinguish regular 2D animation, which I think has not happened. I think Pixar is held to a higher standard. I personally hold Pixar to a higher standard. When you hold something to a higher standard, it doesn't mean if they don't meet it, then you hate them. Mm-hmm. It just means you hope that the next one will have more of the qualities that you like them to aspire to. Like, the ambition, creatively, of maybe the first third of WALL-E, right, which right. everyone knows and talks about, is something I like to see them still aspire to. There's nothing in Cars 2, or I would argue Cars 1, that has that kind of ambition. It's very loving, and it's lovely, and it's something your kids will like, but it doesn't have that extra level of ambition, and I do hope that they will continue to find projects where they can have that kind of impact, the impact of that sequence or the first and last sequences in Up and things like that.
In terms of them being held to a higher standard, I mean, is there a point at which we've now seen so many Pixar movies that another Pixar movie is somewhat ho-hum? I mean, a comparison that Mike and I have talked about is the new Radiohead record, which came out, you know, on about 10 days' notice. Nobody knew it was coming. And then all of a sudden it comes out. It's like, oh, it's a new Radiohead record. And then you're like, ah, it's just a new record. Then you listen to it and it's like, ah, it's just a new Radiohead record.
Yeah. I mean, I think everything is at its most exciting when you've never seen it before. It is interesting that it doesn't seem to be a Pixar sequel problem or necessarily a Pixar I've seen these characters before problem. I think it is a little bit related to this particular movie. But, you know, in fairness to them, you can't put out, you know, 10 or whatever films and have everyone love all of them equally. That's not right. realistic. So the fact that you can look at them and say, yes, if I were ranking them from, you know, one to whatever, this would be near the bottom. So what? Something's always going to be near the bottom. Yep. I just personally don't love this one as much as I love
some of the
other
ones. If you're going to insist on ranking, that's how it works.
Right.
Absolutely. So that's all I'm saying. But anyway, so Cars 2, Take Your Kids, I think, is something that Stephen and I would both be behind. But
and then come to the blog or to the Facebook page and tell us
absolutely
where we went wrong.
Come to...
Wait.
Well, I don't know about that.
Just don't bother telling us where we went wrong. Have fun. Go outside.
So, you know, we've come to a point in the show where we're going to do something that actually I thought you guys were going to do while I was not here, but apparently...
We talked too much.
Apparently it was not possible.
Somehow the show managed to fly completely off the rails.
Shocking.
I don't know how it happened.
So we are returning for another installment of the Regrettable Television Pop Quiz.
Oh, Linda, is so there glad. Some sort of song that goes with
no.
that?
No.
Sing it.
Turns out
sing the song.
Sing the song.
Come on.
Regrettable Television Pop Quiz. Anyway, so we're doing a pop quiz, and we've all brought a clip so that it's not just my clips. These are clips that everyone is sharing. So, Mike Katz, if you want to hit us up.
Luckily, the bar is closed, so I am walking in a straight line right now.
Everyone is looking amazing, and that's all that really matters.
I'm just waiting for my first beach scene to take my pants off.
Ryan hasn't eaten in, like, since we started filming, so she's been delusional.
Anybody?
This was
my
logo.
This is logo. This is the A-list.
I was going to say, is the A-list back already?
It's not back quite yet. This is the promo reel. The show returns on July 25th, I think it is.
So is that making you happy?
I'm giving
right
you
now?
An early heads up. This is so not making me happy because I don't care what you people say. I'm not watching it this time, even so I can report back for the pop quiz, because this is a second season of the most appalling specimens of homo humanity you will ever see.
I feel like our listeners should weigh in on whether you should watch this.
And none of them should be allowed to get married. I don't care what the law says.
Oh, man.
Now that's just hurtful. All right.
Moving on.
Number two.
Well, it seems like, you know, as a Jewish guy with this beautiful, exotic wife, that you're really kind of getting a great deal.
Yeah.
And I would try and negotiate a steamed dumpling or maybe a wonton, something like that I know you like. I'm going to go with Jib is Right.
Oh, that's not with Jim.
Yeah.
Marriage Ref.
I was just going to say, is that Marriage Ref?
It is Marriage Ref.
Is that back? I thought that was a...
Wow.
Yeah, it's back. And it has not gotten any better since... they've basically overhauled it completely, and it's just as bad. That's the thing that's remarkable about
it. See, my only knowledge of whether that was any good or not was based on Donald Trump. Saying, yeah, I went on your show, The Marriage Ref, and it was terrible.
Yeah, he was right about that, by coincidence. Yeah, The Marriage Ref, in case you could not tell, I'm sure you could, that was Jerry Seinfeld who does that show, along with Julianne Moore and Ricky Gervais. and it hurt to watch a little bit. And the three of them laughed so hard at themselves that I kind of wondered what was up with them a little bit. Because they were really too giggly.
You thought they were rehearsing for an episode of this podcast.
I was going to say, you're throwing glass. Yeah. You're throwing stones there.
Exactly.
Is the host guy still there? He's not bad.
Yeah, Tom Papa. I met him at a TCA thing. He was a very nice guy. Really, really nice guy. And I really wanted that show to be good because I'd met him and he was so sweet.
He's
and then it's so bad.
He's a comics comic. He's one of those people that comics really dig.
He is. Anyway. All right, clip number three.
I want you to muster all the energy you can, all this dark energy.
Oh, big orb.
What?
Huge orb just shot from the wall towards you, Adam.
There's a light that just shot up.
You picked the wrong person, Raymond. That was the wrong answer. I said, go after Dan.
And for the record, that almost sounded like a growl right before you started.
No, there's footsteps behind me.
Any guesses?
That's Ghost Hunters, right?
Yeah, it's similar. It's a show called Paranormal Challenge on the Travel Channel. The challenge being that nothing paranormal happens. This is an example of a breed of show like the Ghost Hunter show, which shares creative DNA, whose central premise is indistinguishable from that of an 11-year-old girl's slumber party.
Yep.
Because instead of 11-year-old girls, you just take some burly dudes in goatees and Ed Hardy shirts.
Yep.
You hand them.
Oh, I'm there already.
You hand them a night vision camera.
Wait, so
and,
am I?
And for no reason, why not? An oscilloscope from Radio Shack. You shove them into a dark building, and you watch them proceed to freak each other the hell out.
Yeah.
It's just nothing but standing around in the dark going, felt a sudden movement of air. It's like, really? I would call that a draft, but okay, it's a sudden movement of air. I mean, this show is basically just tweens standing in a bathroom mirror chanting Bloody Mary. That's all the show is.
Yeah.
And the thing that's really galling about it is the pseudoscience, these oscilloscopes. They make a big thing of how much evidence they're collecting. This is really good evidence.
Right.
Where are you going to publish this crap? What are you doing with this? Is there a journal called It's Slightly Chillier Over Here Monthly? I mean, if there's... the journal would have to be called, like, nope, my bad, just a raccoon. That's it. It's awful. It's galling.
Okay, I apologize to everyone on Marriage Ref. Go ahead.
Paranormal Challenge.
Mike Katzeff, cue up our fourth clip.
I'm totally bummed out. I didn't have a one-on-one date with Ashley. I'm at a disadvantage because she hasn't seen my face yet. Next time I'm with Ashley, I am going to take the mask off.
I like how hard they're trying not to pay royalties to Andrew Lloyd Webber.
Yeah.
Or use Bach because that's too high class.
Yeah.
Now, the reason that I chose this very, very, very obvious clip is because it sort of boils down so much of what is thought-provoking about so much reality television. This is, of course, from The Bachelorette. I don't need to make you guys guess. And the incredibly valuable lesson is about not complaining about obstacles you create for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
This particular aspirant on The Bachelorette wore a Catwoman mask.
Aww.
Because he wanted to teach everyone a valuable lesson about judging people by appearances, which of course led everybody to judge him based on the fact that he was wearing a Catwoman mask.
Which is less about judging by appearance and more about judging by being strange.
Right.
And it was
by
sort
character.
Of like, clearly I was at a disadvantage due to my insistence that I go everywhere with a parrot on my shoulder. Everybody's always like, what's with the parrot? And
and I wanted people to judge me not by my parrot-less appearance, but I wanted people to judge me as they would if they knew I had a parrot on my shoulder all the time. And then I found that they really were unable to see past the
parrot. Doesn't that feel, though, like one of these really cheesy producer ideas? Like, I got a great idea. You need a gimmick, kid. And he just hands
But the guy was so serious. Because clearly, you know, you would imagine that people try to get on that show with a certain amount of, like, I'm going to be the guy that whatever. But he was sort of grieving.
Yeah.
Like, the entire time. He was sort of grieving that he was in this horrible position with this grave disadvantage.
That he had found himself on The Bachelorette.
Somehow,
in a pool of shallow, unthinking people?
Yeah. Well, you know, he's a little deeper, that guy.
Yeah, okay.
Obviously, she needs to pick Ben F.
I have no idea. I'm happy to say I have no idea. No, that's one of the guys with all the flopsy hair. You root for the guys with the flopsy hair. This woman has a thing for dudes with flopsy hair. That's uncommon on The Bachelorette. You see a lot
Call
of the
me,
more,
Ashley.
You see a lot of this kind of like super clean cut dudes. Mm-hmm. You don't see a lot of the kind of flopsy, greasy hair. She likes the flopsy. Oh,
excuse me, flopsy, greasy?
We're not talking about you. Okay. I know sometimes that adjustment is difficult. I am not talking about you.
A really basic question here. The guy with the mask, he didn't want to be judged by his appearance. He wanted to be judged by his stupidity. He wanted
stupidity.
To be judged by his stupidity. Is he hot? I mean, when he takes off the mask?
He looks exactly like you would think he would look.
He's neither wearing the mask because he's ugly, nor is he wearing the mask because he always gets chicks because he's so unbelievably hot. I mean, compared to average people, guys who go on The Bachelor are good-looking guys.
Sure.
But he's not. It's not like he takes off the mask and you're like, wow, that guy, I bet, never has to talk to anyone. And I've met guys who are like that.
Yeah.
And so I know what I'm talking about. And he's not one of those guys either.
When they do the big reveal.
It's not a rubber mask. It's not a, you know, full.
He's not coated in latex. Like, he's not like.
Right.
That would be a whole different kind of reality show.
It's
not Mission Impossible.
Circling back to the cars with seats question, are you telling me that superhero comics have been leading me astray about disguises and secret identities all this time?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The only other thing that I would say about The Bachelorette is from our friend Margaret, who reached out with the prediction, the show is going to end with Ashley flying off to Nigeria to marry an impoverished prince who sent her an email asking for a loan.
That is probably true, too.
Because this is... And this is quite a statement, the most gullible Bachelorette
it's
yet.
True. And not that really is saying
not
something.
A thinker.
I
anyway,
would watch that finale.
That is the regrettable television pop quiz, and I think we all did very well. Stephen gave us a nice gimme at the end there. So when you hear this podcast, we will be heading into July 4th weekend. So we were going to briefly have a little chat about July 4th, the loudest and most sparkleriest of holidays.
Stupidy.
What July 4th means to me. Now, you know, when I think July 4th and, you know, like exultations involving July 4th, I think Glenn Weldon.
That's right. That's right.
That's where my brain goes, like, that seems like a hold a sparkler kind of guy. Yeah.
That guy's going to go right down to the Washington Monument and check in with all the tourists.
How,
oh, my God. I can't imagine.
And how are you fireworks. On?
It's hot. It's crowds.
You have to go through a metal detector.
They do not allow
You're
booze.
Not allowed to bring beer.
Now, I'll tell you this. I moved to D.C. at the end of June, 3 years ago. And the first July 4th weekend that I was here, one of my buddies was working at that time at a law firm in downtown D.C. Mm-hmm. It's basically like across from where all this is happening, and they have balconies. So they had a party and they had booze. And it was, you didn't have to be in the crowds and you didn't have to deal with
looking
anything.
Looking at it from afar,
and it was not afar, it was a near. It was right there.
You know, what you're saying is that the founding holiday of our democracy is best experienced from among the plutocracy.
I'm saying if you have to celebrate democracy, for God's sake, don't do it with people. Don't do it around just anyone.
I would mock you for this, but as I recall, my tentative July 4th plans involve being on a friend's 60-foot yacht in the Potomac behind the Lincoln Memorial.
Boo!
You're even worse than me. I only did that once. Anyway, so Glenn Weldon, perfect entertainment for July 4th weekend is what?
Here's what I'm doing. I mean, I'm not a big action movie guy, but I'll watch a blowy-uppy film. Sure, why not? And I understand that it is customary on July 4th for Americans to celebrate our love of country by watching things blow up real good. So,
right.
I'm going to watch some blowy-uppy films. So you're thinking, oh, you're talking about Armageddon. You're talking about your Independence Day. You're talking about
your Die Hard.
I am not talking about. I'm not talking
Christmas
about Die
movie.
Hard. I'm not talking.
Die Hard is about the holidays.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you. I'm not talking about Armageddon or Independence Day because those movies are dumb. I need a film, if it's going to blow up a bunch of stuff, I want it to have a point of view. I want it to have something else to say.
Are you going to Das Boot?
I am going to a director who, as he is blowing things up, he has. You cannot ignore a point of view. I'm talking, of course, about the films of Paul Verhoeven.
Yep, that's where I thought you might be
going. And I'm not talking about Showgirls. Yeah, I'm gay. I'm not going to get you guys to watch Showgirls. I mean, whatever. I'm not talking
Did
about...
You want to?
I'm not so much. I'm not going to talk about Total Recall, because it's a, you know, it's dumb and it's got Schwarzenegger in the middle of it being all big and bulbous and dumb. I'm talking about two films, RoboCop and Starship Troopers. A double feature of these two films. They deliver some visceral, literally in the case of Starship Troopers, some visceral thrills, but they also have a critique of various segments of American society. Now, is it a subtle critique? Is it an incisive critique? No, it is not. You don't look to Paul Verhoeven for subtle, but what you do look for him is big fun and a Z-axis, one might say, a certain extra layer. And then when that's done, for a little aperitif, maybe a little after-dinner mint, you want to hunt down a film that he did in 1983 while he was still in the Netherlands called The Fourth Man for two reasons. One, it's a little twisted, dark, weird little thriller that's really good. And second, because it is the source of a running gag in my household. The main character is a novelist. He goes to a writing convention and he delivers a very pretentious speech in which he says, "I lie the truth."
Ooh.
So whenever I am telling a story to friends, you know, I'm doing the good work of a storyteller. Maybe I'm tightening the narrative arc a little bit. Maybe I'm shaving away some extraneous detail. Maybe I'm just sort of goosing a couple of the details.
Making composite characters and the like.
Whenever I'm doing this, Faustino, my partner, will be there saying things like whatever he says, like, "Oh, it didn't happen that way," or "You're not telling this right," or "My mother isn't a Santeria high priestess," whatever he says. And I turn to him and I say, "I lie the truth." Paul Verhoeven.
Glenn Weldon wins this round already. Why we keep, no one has ever even gone yet.
It's
no,
why we keep inviting Glenn to parties.
Trey Graham, 4th of July.
I got nothing special about the 4th of July except barbecue and corn.
Well, sure.
Oh, that's a thing. That's a good thing.
They make me happy.
What's wrong with barbecue
pork
and corn?
Barbecue.
Of course.
Chip,
the only
pork,
problem,
barbecue.
The only problem with corn is that it's not made of meat.
That's true. I don't want any of this.
It's true. It's technically a plant.
None
sorry,
of this,
Stephen.
None of this dry-rubbed Texas nonsense that they're selling in some joints. I'm talking about chopped pork, Georgia or North Carolina style.
Now, what is the difference between Georgia and North Carolina style?
People will tell you it's in the sauce, mm-hmm. whether there's any ketchup involved.
Ketchup, okay.
Yeah.
Which is, what is your favorite?
I like a sauce with a little tomato in it.
You like a sauce with a little tomato in it. Now, it was my
welcome to our pop culture
fascinating.
So my understanding, I have one more barbecue question. Mm. I absolutely consider barbecue on the 4th of July to be pop culture. The rest
yeah,
of
sure.
you can. My understanding is it does not technically have to have sauce to be barbecue, though.
That is true, although, you know, this is where I differ with the Texas dry rub people.
Yeah.
So
I can't stand the Texas dry rub people.
Curse you.
If I had a nickel.
Send your angry notes to
facebook.com/TexasBarbecue@gmail.com.
Where this sort of plugs into the giddy excess part of the question is that on the 4th of July, unlike most holidays, I will cheerfully, in front of a room full of people or a backyard full of people, eat ribs and chopped pork and barbecue hash and side dishes until I am visibly distended and not appearing at my best.
Uh-huh.
I will eat ribs with my hands and my face in front of people on the 4th of July.
You're going to eat it with your face.
just by osmosis. Just going to shove it right in there. All right, that's excellent, Trey Graham. Stephen Thompson, July 4th.
I posit, I essay, if I may Weldonize for a moment, that July 4th, all that matters, whatever you do on July 4th, that giddy excess be at the core. And I think that it's just incredibly important that July 4th be entirely about just stuffing your face in as joyful a fashion as possible and just hunkering down for just the dumbest, you know, you can have your Verhoeven, but just the dumbest possible television, movies, books, music, right down the line. And for me, I like to try to combine two of those things in the form of the Nathan's Hot Dog Eating Contest on ESPN, which is every July 4th at noon Eastern. And I've already managed to clear my schedule in such a way that I will not be disturbed. I will be in front of my TV, coated in barbecue sauce, watching Joey Chestnut when they compete in the Nathan's Hot Dog Eating Contest on Coney Island. I have always thought, you know, perhaps, seeing as how I have no other, you know, nothing else to distract me, that I might go to Coney Island and watch the event firsthand. But that would entail, as Glenn has discussed, people.
Yeah.
I'm again it as well. I love July 4th. The louder and dumber, the better.
Excellent. This is going to sound repetitive. You have heard this from me before, but I am going to be at the movies. They're cranking up to full throttle the summer programs down at my favorite movie theater, And they will have an Alfred Hitchcock retrospective going, an Elizabeth Taylor retrospective going. The 80s movies series will have started. They have a Coen Brothers thing going, and they are running those movies all day on July 4th. So do not expect to see me, because that is what I will be doing. I will be at the movies, like some of the rest of you, avoiding other people by enjoying some fantastic stuff on the big screen. And honestly, I just see it as a day off of work. That's my holiday. And of course, as always, we want to hear what you will be doing with your holiday weekend. If you are doing anything at all, or if you're not, why you don't care. We're always interested in that. And of course, many of you...
We should have a whole discussion thread for that.
And of course, many of you do not even live in this country, in which case you probably extra don't care. So we'll be happy to hear about that. You can find us on the blog, as always, at Monkey See, or please come to the Facebook page, facebook.com/PCHH, and talk to us about that. So our last segment, as always, is what is making us happy this week, and we are going to start with the wonderful, the fantastic Glenn Weldon.
There's a book coming out on July 16th called Super Gods, What Masked Vigilantes, Miraculous Mutants, and a Sun God from Smallville Can Teach Us About Being Human. It's by Grant Morrison, a brilliant and occasionally frustrating comic book writer of such things as New X-Men, and he's written All-Star Superman, which I consider to be, and I'm not alone in this, the finest Superman story ever told. This book is a guide to the superhero as cultural icon.
I just want to point out that Glenn's copy of this book, which he has in front of him, is heavily dog-eared and page-folded, and he's not kidding about liking this book, because he has beat the hell out of it.
This is actually the concordance.
That's right. I reviewed this book for the Dallas Morning News, and it'll be coming out, I guess, around July 31st, the review at some time. But if you have any interest in the superhero, and I think sometimes, even if you don't, you can't find a better guide to the sort of Jungian importance of superheroes than this guy who loves these characters, but also has a very clear-eyed, a very nuanced appreciation of them. He's also a lively writer, engaging writer, and just bitchy enough to keep it interesting about some of the people he's run into over the course of his career. And he has no love for the anonymous internet commenters. Quote, bullied young men with asthma and shy, bitter virgins with adult-onset diabetes could now gang up like playground toughs they secretly wanted to be, anonymously abuse and threaten professional writers and actors with family commitments and bills to pay.
That's just bitchy enough?
That's just bitchy enough. He builds to this.
Your bitchy requirements, they're high, Glenn Weldon.
He kind of goes off on long things about his experiences with hallucinogens and chaos magic, whatever the hell that is, and those could be trimmed, because he does kind of sound at those moments like your college roommate who'd come into the room at 3 o'clock in the morning on a Tuesday night and wake you up to ask you questions. And at one point in this book, he asks, could mitochondria be the secret scientist's word for soul? And it's like,
he stole that from George Lucas.
Dude, I've got an early calculus test in the morning. I mean, that's what I... But it's a really good, incredibly well-written, and really smart book about superheroes. Super Gods, July 16th.
Very good. Awesome. Trey Graham, what's making you happy this week?
There is no one giant overriding thing that's making me happy this week, but I did compile a small list of things, little things that are making me a little bit happy.
Sure.
Number one, of course, as I mentioned before, the A-listers of New York will very shortly be eligible to get divorced. I am also being made happy this week by wet wipes, because they are soft, they smell nice, and you can use them to remove, let's say, detritus from your sick kitten at 1 a.m.
I am,
he kind of exploded all over the car.
This is what's making you happy?
Wet wipes, because you can remedy the problem. The Capital Fringe Festival is making me happy because it's almost here, and this year I don't have to cover it. I have been able to plead overwork at NPR, and I'm not having to cover it, so I just get to go. And also, something that was mentioned right before we walked into the studio, Mary Tyler Moose is making me happy. This was a series of tweets that surfaced today, in recording time today, by someone named Ken Tremendous on the Twitter. The first one was, I am trying to Netflix the Mary Tyler Moore show, accidentally typed Mary Tyler Moose. I am now trying to create a show called Mary Tyler Moose.
And Ken Tremendous, of course, is the Twitter name of Mike Schur, who is one of the showrunners of Parks and Recreation and has been a sports blogger and a bunch of other great stuff.
And it gets funnier from there, so check that out and see where that meme goes this week.
Strongly recommend. Agree. Enjoy Mary Tyler Moose. All right, Stephen Thompson, what's making you happy this week?
what is making me happy is that I sort of kicked off the dumb fun extravaganza of summer a little bit early. Getting a jump start on the 4th of July crowds, took the kids to Hershey Park in Hershey, Pennsylvania, as one can imagine. This is a chocolate-themed theme park. Surprisingly enough, chocolate, not cheaper. In Hershey, Pennsylvania, one would think that I sort of imagined that they would just have vats of it.
Yeah, they don't make it there anymore, though. They don't make they it's moved to Mexico.
Is that what is? Because we rode the monorail, which led to 9 million mono means one, and rail means rail joke. So with the kids, but they said those silos over there used to hold cocoa beans, and I said to the kids, I was like, what did they hold now? I was trying to imagine what they held now, like, as
sadness,
an alternative.
And
regret. Memories.
Spent nuclear fuel.
So now, they don't actually make... So what you're saying is that Hershey Park is one big lie.
It's an homage to
It's an homage to chocolate.
It's an homage to what was once chocolate.
To a way of life, yes.
The chocolate way of life.
The chocolate.
I retroactively hate Hershey Park.
And thus
we short circuit Stevens
making
his happy.
All right, so now the only thing that's making me happy is the Dippin' Dots. Yeah. No longer billed as the ice cream of the future.
The devil, you say.
It is just Dippin' Dots. Dippin' Dots ice cream.
Really?
It's like going to Disney World and finding out that Tomorrowland is no longer... It's retro now.
Right, right. Tomorrowland is like now.
Yeah.
That's... So
Dippin' Dots are the ice cream of now.
The ice cream... It's just ice cream. It's just
doesn't that mean we've entered the Dippin' Dots era?
It kind of does.
But then why are Dippin' Dots not... Why am I not buying tubs of Dippin' Dots at the store? If this is the ice cream that is available now.
And where is the flying car for the consumer?
Yep.
As a real reporter asked a real representative of the Science Channel last summer at the TV Critics thing I was at.
It's like, where is the
flying car for the consumer?
Wow. Well, I would like to know why Dippin' Dots no longer in the future, now they're just in the present. Anyway, I guess that's sort of making me happy, but I'm just boiling with rage about Hershey Park.
Sorry, you could have just Googled. I mean, you could have asked anybody in the park. Anybody.
I wasn't like, why do they not make chocolate here? Because I thought they did. It wasn't like
the
do
lack
they
of like a chocolate.
What is your big lie, Hershey Park?
So,
I didn't think
so. It
to
turns
ask.
Out what, in fact, is making you unhappy this week is your own lack of curiosity.
But I didn't even. It wouldn't have occurred to me to. You know what it is? I lack the skepticism that you bastards
possess.
You know
possess. What? You know what, Stephen? I bet
I'm too credulous. I have too much faith. Too much faith and joy. That's my problem.
I've said that about you.
I bet this is information about Hershey Park. I bet this is information that you could have found in a book.
All right.
Had you read
one? All right, you win this round, literacy.
Possibly even in a pamphlet from the Pennsylvania Tourism
maybe even
Authority.
On a, probably, possibly even on a sign.
Black. Oh, Sprout, they're... Stephen, there was a plaque. I'm sure there was a somewhere.
What, on the roller coaster I rode? I wasn't there for information, I guess.
Stephen's like, where are the Oompa Loompas? what's making me happy this week? I'm going to go back to Silver Docks, where I spent the week, and mention a short film that won the Audience Award for in the shorts category. And it's called Mr. Happy Man, and it... deals with the fellow in Bermuda who stands on the sort of median in a roundabout. They have very, very, very dense traffic patterns in Bermuda because of the number of people and the size and the number of roads and all that stuff. And he stands out there every morning, whatever the weather, stands out there on the median and waves to everyone and yells, I love you, I love you, I love you, have a great day, I love you. And it sounds like it would be so weird, but when you see him do it, it's great. People just love him. And they drive by and they wave, and he's out there every single day, and he's like an old guy, and he just goes out there every day, and this is what he does. He just yells at people all day, I love you, I love you. And they smile, and he blows kisses. And it's one of those things that's just unironically wonderful. And in the Q&A after the screening of this film, the director, who's I'm unfortunately not going to come up with his name off the top of my head, but we'll put it on the blog, was talking about how he was researching this film and considering making it with this guy. And he was trying to figure out how to find the guy, how to get in touch with him. And somebody said, well, why don't you just, you can just call him. This is his number, you know, whatever. You can just. And he said, oh, you know, so I called his house and his wife answered the phone. I said, you know, that I wanted to speak to him. And so she put him on the phone. And he said, the first thing I heard when he picked up the phone was, I love you. I love you. I love your family. I love your mom. I wish you well and all this stuff. And he said, and I just sat there and I thought, this is going to work. This is going to work. And it's one of those things that's the sort of magic of these little documentaries is that you can't always tell what it's going to be like from what it's about. Some things that seem like they should be really interesting. And I saw a couple like this too. Subject matter that sounds interesting that turns out to just be very boring to watch as a film versus little things like this, which kind of seem like little fluffy bits of nothing, but it actually winds up feeling very profound. There's a great, if I can say one more story about it, there's a woman who says that when she was going to the hospital to have her baby, she drove by and he, for some reason, was looking the other way when she drove by the roundabout. And so he didn't see her and wave to her and say, I love you, as she drove through the roundabout, as he did every day when she was going to work. So before she went to the hospital, she made her husband turn around and go back around the roundabout so that she could go by, and on her way to the hospital, he could yell out, I love you, because she just felt like that was how she wanted to go off to the hospital. She wanted to make sure that she saw him, and that it wasn't like she didn't mess up her omen, which was, you know, she had to see him. Mm-hmm. So it's an incredibly charming film. It is absolutely what's making me happy this week, along with seeing a lot of people's labors of love over the last week, which is what I really did. And, you know, documentaries are not like big, highly financed studio films. They are somebody's labor of love. That's a great honor and a great opportunity to see all of that all in one place from all these different kinds of folks who are interested in so many different topics. So that's what's making me happy this week.
So documentary festivals, thumbs up.
You bet. Absolutely. Find one near you. Watch for them on, as I said, on HBO, on PBS. You will have a few opportunities to see some of them, and I'll try to keep you up to date on which ones are available. So that brings us to the end of our show. Another episode of Pop Culture Happy Hour has come and gone, and I'm awfully glad to be back with
Welcome
all
back.
Of you again.
It's good to have you
home, Linda.
And with all of you. And you can follow all of us on Twitter. Nothing has changed in my absence, I assume. You can follow me and the blog at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Glenn at G.H. Weldon. That's Weldon. You can follow Trey at Trey Graham. Trey with an E. Graham like the cracker. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen. That's Stephen. You can follow our esteemed producer, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff. That's K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our happy in-and-out music, which you are enjoying right now. And thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
So glad to be
here. And thanks to all of you for being here. And I will see you back here next week.
And now, when you think about partying in New Orleans, you probably think Mardi Gras or the New Orleans Jazz Festival. But today we're going to tell you about another bash that's become nearly as big in the Big Easy, the Essence Music Festival. It's now in its 17th year. The festival takes place this weekend, and it features some of America's biggest entertainers and newsmakers, from recording artist Usher to CNN news anchor Soledad O'Brien and Anderson Cooper. Some 400,000 people are expected to attend this year, and to learn more about the festival, we've called upon Essence Magazine's general manager, Joy Collins. She's also in charge of the event. Thank you so much for joining us. I don't even know how you have time to talk to us, but thank you.
Thank you for having me. I'd make time any day.
Well, thank you so much. Do you remember how the festival came about? I know that you've been in charge for the last 4 years, but I feel as though it's like gumbo. It's always existed. But it had to have started somewhere.
Yes, it actually started when Essence Magazine was celebrating its 25th birthday. So it began really as a celebration and really to give back. A part of the music festival has always been empowerment. And so Susan Taylor, who was our editor-in-chief at the time, actually said that we can't have a party in New Orleans without having a purpose behind it. So every year when we come down, we not only put on the best concerts with the best entertainers and star power across the world, but we also put on free programming in our Essence Empowerment Experience, which is where we talk about those issues that matter most to African Americans, and we're going to bring the best of speakers. Steve Harvey will be there, Yanla Van Zandt, Al Sharpton. We're going to have some of those biggest names around talking about those social issues, whether it's education, whether it's community give back, that really we need to know as we go back to our communities and we figure out how can we bring back what we've learned here at the Essence Music Festival to transform our community.
And you also have an experience for 50 women. Actually, there are two things I wanted to talk to you about. The fact is this really does have a real economic impact on New Orleans.
Yes,
can you talk a little bit about that? I mean, you really do involve the city in this.
It absolutely does.
How does
in fact,
work?
It takes thousands upon thousands of people to mount this festival, many of whom we actually employ and source through the local community of New Orleans. And I also have to say that our partners, the City of New Orleans, the State of Louisiana, the Superdome, the Convention Center, our venues that host our activities, they open their arms and they welcome us to come into the city year after year. We'll have been in the City of New Orleans now 16 of the 17 years.
16 of the 17 years, the one year that it was not in New Orleans was...
Yes, was 2006. That was actually after Hurricane Katrina. It just was too soon to host the festival in the city as they were still rebuilding. But really, 2007 thereafter, we came right back again. And really, we think of New Orleans as home.
You're also having an experience for, 50 women from New Orleans who are undergoing some sort of a program and experience there. They're having a VIP experience at the festival with music legend Chaka Khan. Would you tell us a little bit more about what that's about, what they're doing?
We're finding 50 women in the local community of New Orleans, and we're mentoring them all weekend long and all year long, and we're giving them a VIP experience to the Essence Music Festival. We're bringing them out actually to hear Chaka Khan give us that gift of her voice at the Superdome on Saturday night, and then we're having small, intimate conversations with them where we're going to train them on jobs, how to prepare for jobs, how to get jobs, how to find jobs, and then on how to equip their families, whether it's education, whether it's food. We're going to help them to solve those issues that are most relevant to these 50 women, and then we're going to stay with them throughout the year and really provide them with this enrichment. And we're going to bring them back next year for the 2012 festival and sit them down and ask them, how has this partnership between Essence and the Chaka Khan Foundation made a difference in your life?
Are there any artists who just make you crazy? You just think, I just can't. You wouldn't tell me if they did, but come on.
Oh, my
come
goodness.
On,
they all make me crazy.
Oh,
we really have some great eye candy this year. I tell you, we really do. But I have to say, I am really excited about New Edition's 30th anniversary celebration. I think they have some great surprises that they're going to show us. Of course, they have an amazing catalog. They're going to do all of those songs that made them who they are. But they also have given such a tremendous gift to the celebration of R&B that we are celebrating this year. And I think that they're going to take us on a journey of the past 30 years, and I'm just crazy to see that journey and to see from these guys who have really been trailblazers in their genre.
Joy Collins is the general manager of Essence Magazine. She's the organizer of the 2011 Essence Music Festival. It is one of the largest music and culture festivals in the world. It starts today and runs through the weekend in New Orleans. Joy Collins, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
When Ernie Kovacs was a star in the early days of live television, he was called a clown, an oddball, and an innovator. The year since 1962, when he died in a car crash at the age of 42, he's been hailed as a genius. That might be hard to convey. Much of the humor for which he became noted was visual. A trio of musicians wearing gorilla suits and playing as if they were part of a children's toy. A lady in a bubble bath who gets visitors popping up in her suds. Ernie Kovacs rarely told jokes, and he didn't believe in punchlines. He was funny in an unhurried, usually unscripted, almost throwaway way, as when he'd wander into the audience with a deck of cards.
You two know each other?
I'm afraid not.
Have you ever seen each other before in your life?
No, sir.
Did I in any way talk to you before this program?
No.
Did I show you the card or tell you any particular card in the deck?
No, no.
Did I tell you any particular card in the deck?
No.
Then we can't do the trick. So, have to find somebody else I'd talk to.
A new DVD box set of Ernie Kovacs' work is out this summer. 13 hours of shows, specials, and bits culled from his career in the days when the national television audience was relatively small and could be enchanted by seeing a man pour milk sideways, which Ernie Kovacs figured out you could do if you tilted the set sideways, which he did. His humor didn't make an audience laugh so much as gasp or shake their heads.
See, Ernie didn't have a laugh track. Ernie did not need an audience. Ernie just needed Ernie. And he affected me because of his love of television as more than a means of transmission. It was also part of the creation.
George Schlatter became a friend of Ernie Kovacs when his wife, Jolene, appeared regularly on the Kovacs show. Mr. Schlatter would go on to produce Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In, one of the many shows from Sesame Street to Late Night with David Letterman that have been inspired, sometimes unwittingly, by the way Ernie Kovacs delivered a gag with images.
The only arguments we ever had were about the necessity for punchline. My whole life has lived on punchlines, and Ernie avoided them very intensely. I'd say, Ernie, you're so close to a punchline. He says, no, this is good. And there's a famous thing about it. He called me one day and he said, could I come over to the studio? And he would tape all day and all night, and he had this whole studio set up at ABC. And I went by, and Ernie was standing on a raised stage next to a car. And he said, look at this fine automobile. Touched the fender, and the car went through the floor. And Ernie said, now then, is that a punchline? Oh, yeah, Ernie, that's a big punchline.
Robert Smigel was written for Saturday Night Live and Conan O'Brien. He is Triumph, the insult comic dog. Became a fan of Ernie Kovacs when he watched some of his old videos at the Museum of Radio and Television.
It's always hard to explain Ernie Kovacs without sounding extremely pretentious, because you use terms like he was ahead of his time and pioneer, all these kind of high-minded terms, and then you watch clips, and it's the silliest visual stuff. It's a guy spilling milk sideways. And meanwhile, you're saying, you see, he was breaking new grounds with the medium, and he was exploring, and oh my God, I have to take this call.
We'll get back to Robert Smigel a little later. Bill Sheff's written comedy for David Letterman for more than 20 years. He says that while it's a stretch to see Letterman as some kind of direct comedic descendant of Ernie Kovacs,
Dave is a student of television history. I don't think it's an accident that Bill Wendell was the announcer on the old NBC show, especially considering that he was Ernie's announcer and one of the players. And, you know, I don't think that that's an accident. And I think that Dave loves television history, and I think that he liked that connection.
Ernie Kovacs had what we would now consider to be an astonishingly small audience.
Yes, that's true. That's true. Sometimes you can hear him in the theater. Yeah, but I don't think that an audience is the best way of measuring somebody's influence.
Mr. Sheff sees David Letterman's old viewer mail segments as being influenced by a Kovacs bit called Mr. Question Man. Announcer Bill Wendell reads from a letter supposedly sent by a college student about to have dinner with the girls and their house mother.
As she is rather finicky about good manners, I would not like to do anything that would cause embarrassment. The girls all voted to have fried chicken, which brings up a point of etiquette. I would so much appreciate your answer as soon as possible. Can fried chicken be eaten with the fingers?
No. Fried chicken should be eaten by itself. The fingers can be eaten separately.
So what was he like to work with, Ernie Kovacs?
He was just a sweetheart. He was just a very sweet man with the actors and the crew.
Jolene Brand Schlatter had her own rich career as an actress and model. She was the first woman to be kissed by Zorro. But she's happy to be best remembered for being the girl in the bubble bath, sudsing herself while a periscope popped up in her tub. She says that Ernie Kovacs didn't tell her who or what would pop up, only that when it did, she should just keep sudsing, even with
people coming out, and then when the dog came out, that was a shocker. And, of course, when the tub moved, he did warn me about that. He said, oh, by the way, you're going to go through that wall over there in the tub. Yes.
The tub moved.
Jolene Brand also played a recurring role in the Nairobi Trio, those gorillas that wore tuxes and bowler hats while they played music.
Ernie had been doing the Nairobi Trio in Philadelphia with Edie, his wife, Edie Adams. And when he came to California, Edie's career was going in a different direction. And Ernie wanted to reprise it again. And so he had Jack Lemmon, and he asked me to do it, the Nairobi Trio, with him also. So I was the blonde gorilla at the piano. So that was me.
And Jack Lemmon was?
Was the other one. He was the one who hit Ernie on the head with the little timbales.
And how do we explain the Nairobi Trio?
How do you explain it?
Yeah.
Well, I don't think you can. It's just such a visual delight. You just go with it. You see it once and you say, I can't believe what I just saw.
The small audience tuned in may also not have noticed that one of the musical gorillas was sometimes played by Frank Sinatra. Robert Smigel finally got off the phone, and the comedy writer explained that while some of Ernie Kovacs's comedic experiments worked better than others, even those bits that fell flat have impact.
He did a lot of great stuff, and then a lot of stuff, you watch it and, you know, a lot of experiments go badly. You know, that's the price that people pay when they're experimenting in front of everybody. Sometimes the work gets duplicated and perfected by your peers and people who follow you. There are things he did that I saw years later when this DVD collection came out and finally realized, oh, I see, I was ripping off Ernie Kovacs. I didn't know. Sorry, where do I write the check?
Ernie Kovacs took conspicuous joy in his work, but his heyday lasted just a little under 5 years. He had a happy marriage to the actress and singer Edie Adams, but a painful custody suit for the two daughters from his first marriage. At the time of his death, Ernie Kovacs owed $500,000 in taxes, because as Edie Adams once said, Ernie felt that he'd earned all that money, not the U.S. government. We asked George Schlatter if his tax problems, custody battle, or low ratings had hung heavy on Ernie Kovacs.
Nothing hung heavy on him. I don't think Ernie could have cared less about his tax problems. Ernie's tax problems were the government problem, not him. And Ernie worried about nothing.
When you take a bath nowadays, do you ever worry about stuff coming out of the tub?
Yes, definitely. Definitely. Think about it all the time.
Jolene Brand Schlatter, the original Girl in the Suds on Ernie Kovacs shows. We also heard from her husband, producer George Schlatter, and comedy writers Bill Sheft and Robert Smigel. The Ernie Kovacs Collection DVDs are just out. A lot of the material survived only because Edie Adams cashed in her insurance policy to buy his tapes back from the networks just before they would be dumped into a landfill. You can see video clips of Ernie Kovacs at our website, npr.org.